This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, in for Jen White. We're likely to hear a lot about policy at this week's Democratic National Convention. One policy that's come up a lot in the past 4 years is criminal justice reform. Since the death of George Floyd, more Americans have been taking a critical look at the criminal justice system as it exists today. Polls show that most Americans support some kind of prison reform. But there's a group of people who want to change the system entirely.
My name is Carlton. I'm from Randolph, Massachusetts. I'm a avid abolitionist, and the reason for that is because policing the private prisons and the entire industrial complex that America has been founded on provides nothing but profit for the ruling class and quote-unquote wealthy elite. Criminality and criminals are manufactured by a system that starves communities of their resources. If they were to take that money that they put towards policing and prisons and put them into the communities, I guarantee you a lot less people would be criminals.
No prisons. That's a concept that's difficult for some people to imagine. Here to help us get a picture of what that could look like is James Kilgore. He's the co-director of the First Followers Reentry Program. He's also the author of Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. James, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Sasha. Good to be with you.
Kim Wilson is the co-host and producer of the Beyond Prisons podcast. Kim, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And Nicole Lewis is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Welcome back to 1A, Nicole.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, Nicole, there was not a lot of talk last night about police reform at the DNC. Do you think that we might see more of that talk later this week, or should we?
I think so. I mean, I think it's sort of an issue that is, given everything that has gone on the spring and the summer, that's pretty hard to avoid. And I also think that Joe Biden is going to be called on his record. And so I would expect that we would get some discussion of what we've seen in the streets, of the need for reforms, of George Floyd, and just the impact that it has had on the African-American community and beyond.
So we're focused on the abolitionist movement. What is abolition in this modern context, Nicole? What are we talking about here?
So, you know, I've written about this for the Marshall Project and talked to many abolitionists in several different states. And I'd say the core sort of framework here for me is that they're connecting, right, prison, policing, the criminal justice system. They're saying that it's explicitly racist, that it's not just some sort of unfortunate side effect, but that the roots of these systems have their roots in racism. And so if you trace it all the way back, you know, people have pointed out that the first sort of semblance of organized police were people who chased down escaped slaves, right, and brought them back into slavery. And then you fast forward a little bit in time, we've got organized police, right, enforcing black codes during the Jim Crow era. It's the police who are there enforcing the racist laws that meant that, you know, people couldn't sit at the lunch counters with their white counterparts or couldn't be in certain sections of the community. And it was the police, right, who enforced those laws and who sicked dogs on protesters and brought out water hoses. Mm-hmm. So this is not just a coincidence, right? And so to in order to dismantle those systems, in order to have any shot or opportunity for people of color to have, you know, some equality in the United States, that we have to dismantle those systems, that we can rethink their functioning and to come up with a good system of public safety, right? So in this case now, the call for defunding is about moving the resources that get spent on maintaining the criminal justice system into communities that have been underserved, yeah. Providing for things like education and healthcare, right, after school programs in order to create public safety.
Kim, the last time some of us may have heard about abolitionists was back in a U.S. history class at some point. Is what they teach in school about abolition in the U.S. consistent with what it actually means to be an abolitionist today?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think that part of what we get taught in school, if it's in, you know, social studies class or whatever course, is really kind of glossing over the history. That you may read a little snippet about Harriet Tubman, you may read a little bit, you know, about Frederick Douglass, and that's usually it, right? So if we think about what's happening today and in terms of abolition today, obviously we're connecting to to the past. And obviously, the historical and iconic figures that we've studied in the past are important and relevant to the movement and to the things that are going on now. I think that a part of the failure in terms of what's happening in the schools is, you know, we also need to think about who is making decisions about the kind of curriculum that is taught in those schools and what gets taught and, you know, how those things get taught as well. So I don't think that we're getting a very complete or robust picture if we're just looking at, you know, the kind of education that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, thinking about the movement today, I think that, you know, there are spaces outside of formal education that many of us, you know, have come to the movement through. That's how we find our way to abolition, is through kind of political education, through organizations, through, you know, a friend that's involved in an issue, you know, that you care about. And we enter those spaces and engage other people in deep study around, you know, particular issues. And we look at the history of prison abolition, of slavery, you know, of the abolition of slavery, and what have you.
James, when you say abolish prisons, what does that mean?
That means abolish prisons. I think we're talking about imagining a different kind of world and a different kinds of systems that exist at the moment. I like to think of abolition as both an absence and a presence. It's an absence of institutions of punishment, prisons, policing, jails, immigration detention centers, lockup, psychological, psychiatric facilities, and so forth. But it's a presence. It's a presence of some of the things that Nicole talked about, a presence of communities that are able to meet their basic needs, that are able to build relationships, that are able to envision a different kinds of society where we address harms by providing people with support, by providing people with opportunity rather than providing them with punishment. The system today punishes people for being unhoused. It punishes them for having mental health problems. It punishes them for having substance abuse problems. We don't need punishment. We need what Stevie Wilson, a prisoner in Pennsylvania, calls creating what we need to live, love, and thrive.
Right.
That's from a prison abolitionist locked up at the moment, a black and queer man in Pennsylvania prisons.
So, James, how do you respond to this? We got a Facebook message from Frank that says, abolishing prisons is crazy talk. Ask anyone actually living in high crime areas, mostly black or brown people.
It's not crazy talk. What's crazy talk is the fact that we have over 2 million people locked up in prisons and jails at the moment. We have 4.5 million people under some kind of mass supervision, probation, or parole. We are a complete outlier in the United States in the global criminal legal system. So I think we need to look at how crazy that is, how completely outlandish that is, and begin to unpack that and look at how we might move down a different path.
Nicole, are there parallels between traditional abolitionist demands and what we've heard from the Black Lives Matter protests?
Sure. I mean, by traditional abolitionists, do you mean, you know, in a modern context, or people working to abolish slavery?
Well, I mean, yeah, because if we want to understand the Black Lives Matter movement and the racial reckoning that's happening today, we have to look at their roots, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think that that's right. I mean, I think it's a couple of things important to point out is many people are just getting engaged and politicized around Black Lives Matter for the first time, that they've watched a video of a police, you know, killing a man, right, on video. And that was enough for them to say something about our policing is not working here. And so the Black Lives Matter movement, right, offers up a framework and a community and a connection and protest in order to sort of grapple and deal with that beginning of consciousness, right? And so I think many people in the Black Lives Matter movement who were, you know, born, that was birthed out of the acquittal of Zimmerman after Trayvon Martin was killed and was strengthened, you know, after the killing of Mike Brown, have basically been saying, we've been working on criminal justice reform for years. And look at where we are now. And so they're saying, right, we can no longer go this way. We can't have a conversation anymore about police body cameras, and we can't talk about disciplining officers when the end result is that people are still being murdered by the police, being killed by the police. Mm-hmm. And so there are certainly, you know, connections, roots, certainly the Black Lives Matter movement, many people, you know, inside that movement are calling for the defunding of the police and prisons. They're calling for abolition. You know, and I think that there's a general weariness about where we still are in terms mm-hmm. of making these institutions more just and more fair.
Kim, I wonder if there was a moment for you when you actually realized I'm an abolitionist. And can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I've probably shared this story before in different spaces. But, you know, for me, I came at this the way a lot of people come at this, you know, originally being a reformer or a reformist. I was in grad school. I was doing my graduate research on reentry and looking at issues of voting rights for formerly incarcerated people. And I kept coming up against, you know, questions and issues that were not being resolved, at least in the policy literature, which is where I, you know, was doing this work in public policy, that, you know, really were not satisfying, right? They just didn't quite get at what was going on. And I wanted, and I was interested in, you know, going beyond just the kind of, you know, cost-benefit analysis that is, you know, part of public policy, you know, public policy analysis. So, mm-hmm. you know, I thought about where else can I, who else is thinking about these issues? And that kind of led me down a rabbit hole to, you know, examining, you know, critical prison studies and reading folks like Lisa Gunther, reading folks like Andrew Diltz and Sarah Tyson, the work of people like Dylan Rodriguez and, you know, Dorothy Roberts and on and on and on. And not that all those folks are working in a space that we call carceral studies, but their work is relevant to the kind of, you know, answering the kinds of questions that I was interested in getting answers to. That wasn't a very popular kind of thing to do in grad school, and certainly not in a rather conservative discipline like public policy. So, yeah. You know, my entree into, you know, or my entry point into abolition really came that way. And the more pushback that I got, the further in, you know, I went. And then I had personal experience yeah. with, you know, having two sons that are currently sentenced to life in prison. Mm. And, you know, I know a lot of other people that are currently in prison. So, you know, and it's a victim of multiple forms of harm. I'm also coming at this work because the criminal punishment system was not satisfying. You know, it was not addressing my needs as someone who, you know, wanted to feel safe. It didn't provide those things. It yeah. blamed me for a lot of the problems. And it's decimated, you know, the communities and families and people that I know, including my own.
Yeah. Mark wrote to us on Facebook, says, I am a crime abolitionist. I can choose not to commit crime. That way I don't go to jail. It's simple. It's within my control. It's free and it works. James, I wonder if you can respond to this email we got from Dave. He says, you know, with all the chatter about abolitionists in recent times, we never seem to hear much about Harriet Beecher Stowe and her brother, Henry Ward Beecher. Why is that?
Okay, I'm happy to address those, but I want to just build a little bit on what Kim said to
sure.
talk about how we get to become abolitionists, because I became an abolitionist because of my own experience of being incarcerated in California federal and state prisons for 6.5 years. And even when I went through that, when I came out in 2009, I wasn't a supporter of prison abolition, but I could see from my experience that something dreadfully wrong was happening in those prisons, that an endless line of black, brown, and poor white bodies was coming through the gates doing 20, 30, 40, 50 years. One person I was incarcerated with in Lompoc was doing 552 years. And it made it, it just didn't make any sense. So when I came out, I was put on an electronic monitor, which was supposed to be a reform, an alternative to incarceration. And what I found was that it simply transferred the site of incarceration from the prison cell into my house. Mm-hmm. So that was my part of my experiment with looking at prison reform. And after that, I began to do a lot of research into reform. And as Kim has said, the reform, when the more we reform prisons, the more we create new forms of incarceration. So now we're likely to be using technology to create new forms of what we call e-carceration if we're going to simply tweak the system that exists. And to address the problem of crime, I think we need to think, what are the underlying causes of crime? It's not lack of policing. It's not lack of prisons and jails. It's poverty, structural racism, inequality, lack of quality housing, lack of mental health facilities, and solving all these problems by punishing people when they're actually victims of a system that's unfair and unequal, and as we know, is historically very racist.
Just about 30 seconds before we take a break, James, just the mention here about not hearing about Harriet Beecher Stowe and her brother, Henry Ward Beecher. Why?
I'm not quite sure. I haven't done a deep analysis of that, but there's a lot of history that we don't hear about, and mm-hmm. I'd like to hear a lot more about those who fought for abolition, and particularly in this month of Black August, where we recognize Black freedom fighters that have given their lives for the cause of freedom in this country.
So we'll talk more about your story, James, when we return. Charlie wrote to us on Facebook and wonders, should the officer who murdered George Floyd go to prison? We'll discuss that as well. We're talking about the idea of abolishing prisons with James Kilgore, co-director of the First Followers Reentry Program and author and abolitionist. Kim Wilson, the prison abolitionist and co-host of the Beyond Prisons podcast. And Nicole Lewis, staff writer at The Marshall Project. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Black voters play a crucial role for any Democrat who seeks to win the White House. But some big divides amongst that bloc, and some serious ambivalence, could determine who is elected president this November. Listen now on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
Now let's get back to today's abolitionist movement with James Kilgore, co-director of the First Followers Reentry Program and author of Understanding Mass Incarceration. Kim Wilson is co-host and producer of the Beyond Prisons podcast. And Nicole Lewis is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. The Marshall Project is a nonprofit news organization that's focused on criminal justice reform. I mentioned a Facebook message before we took a break, Kim, and I'd love for you to address this one. Charlie writes, should the officer who murdered George Floyd go to prison? Your thoughts?
The short answer, and this is probably going to upset a lot of people, is no. The fact is that, by focusing on one individual, and obviously, like everyone else, I am upset. I was terribly upset when I saw what happened to George Floyd that afternoon. My initial reaction, like most people, is, yes, you want revenge. But when we step back and we think about that, and again, this is something that, we think about deeply, right? It's mm-hmm. not that we want a consequence-free world. It's that we want to think about different ways to address the kinds of harm that happen.
So what consequence should he pay?
That depends. I mean, I don't get to have the say, right? Mm-hmm. It's not.
If not prison, what else?
Yeah, it's not something that, I would expect to make a decision about by myself or alone, that this is something that we need to engage in a conversation about. And I think that that's part of the problem is that, you know, whereas prison, it seems like the answer for a lot of things for a lot of people, right? And that saying something like, well, we need to talk about that, right? And that we don't have all of the answers and that things have to be very specific, because in essence, what we're doing is, you know, we're focusing on the individual and we're leaving the structure intact. All of the conditions that permit, you know, officers like the person that killed George Floyd to do those harms, right? We're not doing anything about that system by locking up one individual. Instead, what we're doing is we're increasing the size and scope of the prison industrial complex. And that's something that, you know, requires a kind of shift in our thinking, but also requires that we kind of pull back from the tendency that we've been socialized to think about, you know, punishment as the way to address all kinds of harm. And it doesn't fix any of those things. We're going to see, you know, we've seen how many other people being killed by the police since May 25th. Right. So putting one person in prison, as Dylan Rodriguez, you know, says, is really celebrating an exceptional case. It does nothing to address the systemic issues.
I want to get more into James' personal story here. And I think an email here from Jamie will help us do that. He says, what about just not imprisoning nonviolent offenders? Shouldn't serial killers and rapists be in prison? And I want to note, James, you served 6.5 years in prison for political offenses, right?
Correct.
And so what do you think about what Jamie asks here? What about just not imprisoning nonviolent offenders?
I think that creates a number of problems. First, about 50% of the people in state prisons are convicted of something that's so-called violence. So even if we took all of those people out of prison, we would still have a prison system much larger than any other country in the world. But really what that doesn't do is it doesn't deal with the issues of structural violence. It doesn't deal with the things underlying the underlying causes of the system of mass incarceration. So what we really need to think about is how do we create alternatives that do something different. So for example, in my own community, I work, as you mentioned, with First Followers Reentry Program.
Right.
We work with people coming home from prison, trying to help them find housing, trying to help them find alternatives for their life, but also helping them to give back to the community, to create a community that's different than the one that they left, and create a different role for them in that community. I mean, I also do work around the issue of electronic monitoring, trying to get us to think about non-punitive responses to harm, non-punitive responses to violence. We need things like transformative and restorative justice processes to address some of these issues, rather than just the knee-jerk reaction of punishment, or rather than separating people who are incarcerated into the good people and the bad people, and adding more punishment onto the bad people and giving some resources to the so-called good people.
I want to bring Nicole Lewis back into the conversation. Nicole, tell us how young people are engaging with abolitionism.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen a big spike on social media, on Twitter in particular, with young people engaging with all of these ideas, all of the theory, you know, that animates this discussion. I think it's been really, you know, pretty interesting and exciting. You know, I just was looking this morning at I believe a USA Today collaboration that profiled 12 young people who led Black Lives Matter protests in their, you know, hometown. So these are small counties, and, you know, people as young as 17 who said, I'll stand up and I'll take this on. And so you're seeing a combination both on the ground, you know, as example by these 12 young people, as well as on social media. And I think, you know, for the most part, when we looked out and we said, well, who's showing up in the midst of a pandemic to these protests, you know, widely attended, it was you know, pretty diverse, you know, a wide sort of range of age groups, but primarily driven and led by young people. And I think that's been the case for a long time. You know, the people who were first interested, the first, you know, coined the term are millennials. They're people in their 20s and 30s. So,
well, you heard some of the social engagement I read to James and Kim earlier, Nicole. There's also a poll by Gallup from late June to early July that found that only 22% of Black Americans actually support abolishing the police. What are some hesitations that you've seen about the idea?
Sure. First, I'd like to address some of the social media comments. I think, you know, a lot of these arguments are a little bit of a distortion of the conversation. And so, you know, one way that it's been put to me is we've built a system for the scariest people, right? For the serial killers. We've built a system that is designed to take people away and remove them from our society. But the majority of people that were not the majority of people, but the kinds of crimes that we're talking about, that even crimes that are deemed violent, that actually have no violence in them, right? Mm-hmm. Why have we built a system, you know, aimed at our darkest fears, right? How does that make sense? So that's sort of one way to think about it. And I think, again, like James is saying, like Kim is saying, we have to go back and look at some of those underlying causes, right? That this is really what abolitionists are aimed at, that there are no just criminals born, that people are, you know, tracked into crime, right, through poverty, through mental health, right? And then people are targeted. And so one simple way to think about this is, for many people, a drug addiction may mean incarceration. But for many people who are much better resourced, a drug addiction may mean time in rehab, right? It means time away. It means a focus on healing. And so I think, right, the argument is that it's as simple as I can just not commit crime and not wind up in jail. It's not quite the case, right? Mm-hmm. Some people are targeted for those crimes.
Yeah. Well, Joe from Wilmington, North Carolina, also reached out to us. He has some reservations about the idea of abolishing prisons as well. Here's what he left in our inbox.
I used to think jails and prisons were really not necessary. And in 2005, I started teaching for a community college, was assigned to prisons. I'm glad that there are places for people like that. There are some, and yes, improvements can be made. As far as defunding the police, no. Demilitarizing them, absolutely. Because that promotes us versus them, and we don't need that in police.
Kim, Campaign Zero, which is a police reform organization, it launched a campaign called Eight Can't Wait back in early June. But abolitionists have criticized the Eight Can't Wait messaging. Can you talk to us about the conversation that's happening within the activism community around reform versus abolition?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Eight Can't Wait came out with their proposals of, you know, reforms, eight reforms, many of which, and this needs to be said, have already been in place in many cities around the country, right? So, you know, there's that part of it. In response to this, and they've also done something which is, you know, really interesting, but something that we're seeing happening in this moment, and that's to co-opt a lot of the language of abolition, right? So to make it appear as if this is an abolitionist agenda, when in fact it is not. So the Eight to Abolition group collective came together in a very short period of time. I think it was like 24 or 48 hours. And they responded with a political education tool and a platform so that people can educate themselves about what, you know, abolition is, but also presenting a really thorough response in terms of, you know, all of the things that Eight Can't Wait is claiming are going to make people safer, right? So, for example, the Eight to Abolition asked to, you know, or is demanding that we defund the police. And they outlined a number of, you know, different things under that, including things like rejecting any proposed expansion to police budgets, you know, requiring that police, not cities, be liable for misconduct and violence of settlements, and on and on and on. They also demanded that, you know, we demilitarize communities. And I think that this is a really important point. And they, you know, again, listed a number of things under each one of these, you know, major issues, right? Freeing people from prisons and jails. And again, it's not, you know, I would say most people, they hear that and they're like, oh, goodness, definitely not. We cannot let people out of prisons and jails. But again, it's also, you know, what is happening in the popular imagination? We see, you know, popular culture, television, and all of these different shows were fed a steady diet of, you know, these people are scary, these people are doing X, Y, and Z, and all of that stuff. Yeah. And it's like, again, you know, it's not, and we're not naive that, you know, people don't commit really horrible things. We're saying, yes, actually, we know that they do, but that putting someone in a cage is just not sufficient.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll have more from our guests and from you in just a moment. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
This is 1A. We're continuing our conversation about the modern abolitionist movement, and we've been getting a lot of responses from our listeners. Let's listen to another message from a listener who felt conflicted about prisons.
Hi, this is Lisa in Indiana. I have a number of friends and even some family who have been in prison, and I am all for prison reform. I'm completely against the death penalty, and I have also survived abduction, violent sexual assault, and an attempt on my life. I don't think that there's anything that you could say to convince me that there should be no incarceration.
Thank you for sharing that message with us, Lisa. James, I want to address a bunch of emails and Facebook messages that we're getting this hour. Kay Carl tweets, all along the same lines, Kay Carl says, what are some possibilities for consequences, if not prison? I know Kim addressed it earlier, but James, what's your take here? What else, if not prison?
I think we are prisoners of our own imagination at the moment. We've been doing incarceration and over-policing for so long, we've lost the capacity to imagine what it could look like if we stopped relying on this, like even most other industrialized countries do, and start moving some of the resources that are in policing, moving some of the resources that are in the military-industrial complex into communities that have been marginalized, that have been oppressed by mass incarceration, particularly Black and brown communities, indigenous communities, LGBTQIA communities, disabled communities. So we really need to be thinking about how we can move these resources and stop the obsession with punishment. We need to find ways of dealing with harm that builds relationships between people, that builds peace and well-being in communities, not that accentuates the harm. And I can just say from being in prison myself, prison itself is harm. And so when you come out of prison, you're not going to be a better person because you've been incarcerated. And in Illinois, for example, when you're released, you're given $10. So how are you supposed to make a life out of that? So we really need to be looking at the practice that exists and imagining what something oriented toward freedom would look like for people rather than punishment in response to all harm
that's done. So do you have a specific example? Do you have a specific example of consequences?
Well, I think what we need is we need communities to come together to develop institutions and processes to define those consequences, to make people accountable to one another in ways that could involve doing labor, could involve paying money, could involve doing education. There's a whole range of possibilities, but we need to put resources into imagining what those look like and into making them a reality.
James Kilgore is the co-director of the First Followers Reentry Program and author of Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. Kim Wilson is the co-host and producer of the Beyond Prisons podcast, and Nicole Lewis is a staff writer at The Marshall Project. Thank you all. Now remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day, and it's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. This conversation was produced by Emmanuel Johnson and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.